Okay, good. So yeah, do sit comfortably. So I'm just going to give a kind of little introduction and sort of recap on last week. Lots more people. Before tea, and then we'll have tea, and then we'll sort of exploring the next section of the text. Okay, so the text we're exploring is this, the Bodhicharya Avatara of Shantideva. So this is one translation. There's many translations. It's one of the sort of most translated Buddhist texts. Hi, thank you, Kim. It's one of the most translated and probably one of the most influential of Buddhist texts. And as we heard last week, it's particular inspiration to the Dalai Lama. He apparently reads it every single day. And it's also, in terms of our movement, the Tri Ratna, it's the first work that Sangharakshita, our founder, led study on after founding Tri Ratna. And he's always emphasised it as one of our core texts. And hopefully we'll see why he's done that as we explore. So the author, for want of a better word, is Shantideva. So who can remember, maybe someone who was here last week or someone who just from their general knowledge was, who can remember who Shantideva is or was? Maybe we can piece it together, maybe with a few of us. The historical figure. Yes, Lizzie.
A monk who everyone thought was lazy, but was actually busy beavering away. Uh-huh. He came and kind of read this out to the monks and monastery and what was going on.
Right, yeah. Okay, so that's the legend. Yeah, so very good. So can you remember when this was, or can anybody remember when this was?
Fourth century, was it?
A bit later.
Sixth.
800? Yeah. So it's the 800 of the Common Era. Yes, so Shantideva, as Lizzie was saying, he was living in a monastery. It was a monastic university. And, all the other monks thought he was lazy. And then they put him to the test one day. They sort of set him up, really, to make fun of him. They said, oh, it's your turn to teach today, thinking he wouldn't have anything to say. And he expounded this, and then he floated up into the air and disappeared. It's interesting, because so maybe he wrote this in secret. Strangely enough, we don't really know. I always think maybe he just expounded it on the spot as a big, long poem. But what do you think this could mean? It's a legend. I mean, it's probably not literally true. He probably, it's a legend that's grown, but we explored some things that it might illustrate. But maybe we'll just recap on that and see if there's anything. So what might this illustrate? So here he is. He's at this monastic university. All he seems to do instead of doing his studies is sleeping. For some reason, I've got him in a hammock sleeping. I don't know why. But then when called to it, he expounds this great poem, really. As you can see, it's in verses. He speaks this devotional poem. What do you think might be the meaning of this legend? Anyone would like to have a go?
Is it to do with the monks judging as a monk?
Okay, so that's a good thing, isn't it? Yes, so that would be one meaning we could get, that you can never tell what another person's practice is. Mm. Yeah, so I think that's a good point, actually. We don't know. We can't sort of judge by appearances, as it were. So what else? So here we are, so we're at a university. So what tends to happen in a university? a monastic university. It's not a trick question.
Study.
Study, yes, who said that? Yes, okay. So, and there Shantideva sort of seemingly not taking part in any of these studies, but and sort of expounding this Bodhicharya Avatara. What do you think that might be saying?
Something you can't learn in books.
It's a kind of simple point, but I think it's really an important point. It's one that Sangharaj has stressed like again and again and again, that that we do learn about the Dharma, and here we are about the class learning, but sort of facts and details only get you so far, and actually it's not very far. There has to be something else. Sangharaj has got a great saying that we have to find emotional equivalents for our intellectual understanding. So we do need an intellectual understanding, or else we'd have nothing to find emotional equivalents to. But it's like the intellectual understanding is just like a small fraction, and actually the Dharma, the truth, has got to penetrate much, much more deeply into our whole being, our whole emotions, our whole psyche. And so I think this is what could be illustrated by this. You've got this university where people are studying and learning. Here's this person who apparently seems not to be doing that, but yet he's got the greatest depth of all, in a way. So I think that's showing us that our Dharma studies have to go deeper than just book learning, as it were. Yeah. So, and we probably sort of know that, but I think we can always take that deeper. You know, there's so many things we know about the Dharma, don't we? Well, we know, we look at these flowers and we say, well, all things are impermanent. I mean, we know that. We could easily argue it. You know, nobody's going to sort of disprove it. But actually, how deeply do we really know it? If we really knew it, then we wouldn't be shocked or surprised when things actually changed, and we often are, aren't we? Somebody was just saying, we've just had a weekend retreat at Vidrasana, our retreat centre, and it's all going to change next year. Like, loads of it's going to be demolished and rebuilt, which is a great thing, but there's also pangs of, oh no, I don't want it to change, you know, I like that grapevine there, or that fruit tree there, you know. And again, we know it, but we don't know it. And there's many, many truths of the Dharma that are like that. Does that seem to fit with your experience, that we know the truth intellectually, but we don't know it more deeply? Yes? No? Yeah? So I think this is one of the things that this could be getting at, that Shantideva knew something more deeply. So maybe just a little tiny bit more before tea. So can anyone remember what the title, probably says it on here, what the title means, the Bodhicharya Avatara? Can anyone remember? Good job we're doing this again, isn't it?
Something to do with a path.
Something to do with path, yeah. Very good. Something to do with path. Well, maybe we could break it down. Actually, could we have a little scribe? So we've got Bodhi. What does Bodhi mean?
Wisdom.
Wisdom, yeah. Any does more or less mean wisdom. Any advances? Enlightenment. Yes, yeah, so wisdom. So enlightenment would include wisdom and compassion. So it means So it's the word. In a way, we get Buddha from that Bodhi, awake. It literally means awake, and the Buddha is the one who is awake. And then, Charya means path. Yeah. Avatara. What does that mean? It's interesting because that has actually entered our language, that Sanskrit word. Avatar, avatara. kind of to know what that means, and well, and if some of us might be familiar with that word avatar from like science fiction movies and so on. And do you want to have a go? Yeah, brilliant. So it's it's the embodiment of a higher
thing.
Higher thing. Okay, yeah, put that up. Yeah, embodiment of a higher thing. Yeah, that's really good actually. How this translation is given is the Bodhicharya Avatara means a guide to the Buddha's path to awakening. Actually, another way you could say it, which I think, in my humble opinion, might be better, is a guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life. And I think that gives, I think this word avatar, and especially the way Claire's described it, gives more of a sense of, so avatar, you could say, is the visible manifestation of an abstract concept. So we've got this idea of awakening, but that's quite abstract, or the path of awakening. It might inspire us, but it's quite abstract. Whereas in this word avatar, you've got an actual visible manifestation of that. And in the person of the Buddha or the Bodhisattva, you've got an actual manifestation of awakening. So it's not just awakening as this abstract thing, it's an actual awakened being. So I must say I prefer the translation of the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life, which is also a guide to the Buddha's path of awakening. I'll go into this a bit more after the tea break, but you've got... And both are true. So a Bodhisattva would act in particular ways, which we'll explore after tea, how a Bodhisattva would act. And if we, not Bodhisattvas, presumably, act in those ways, that becomes the path to awakening. So you've got the ideas of Buddhism are both path, or the, not the ideas, the practices of Buddhism are both the path and the expression. So before enlightenment, the practices are the path. After enlightenment, what we call the practices are the expression. So something like metta, for example, that's, we practice it as a path. A Bodhisattva or a Buddha just is metta, so that's the expression of their enlightenment. So you've got both the guide to the path of awakening and a guide to the Bodhisattva or the Buddha's way of life. Does that make sense what I'm saying? Is there any questions on that before tea? Okay, good. Hopefully that's good. But yeah, I think the clue is in that avatar bit. As Claire said, the embodiment of a higher thing. And I think, again, the key is the embodiment. You know, the Bodhisattva is the embodiment, the visible manifestation of an abstract concept. So that's what we've got in the Bodhisattva. That's why we have the Buddha as a figure. You know, we don't just have a big bit of writing up there that says enlightenment or something, or awakening. We actually have, as best we can, an image of a person who is awake. Okay, let's have tea. So before tea, we saw that Bodhicharya Avatara meant guide to the path of awakening, or guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life. So yeah, so it's a guidebook, basically. You could see it as well as a book of devotion. But I thought maybe we could explore between ourselves, first of all, what we think it covers. So what steps do you think you need to take to become an awakened being, a Buddha, a Bodhisattva? What qualities do you think you need to develop? So if you call them out, then I'll get one of our scribes, maybe one of you, to see the Peter Dabhadra, to write up. Yeah, so what qualities do you need to develop?
Mindfulness.
Mindfulness, yeah.
Compassion.
Yeah.
Wisdom.
Wisdom, yeah. Generosity, yeah.
Patience.
Patience, yeah.
Commitment.
Brilliant.
Serenity.
What was that? Serenity?
Morality.
Morality, yeah. Great.
Stillness.
Stillness, yeah.
Courage.
Yeah, great.
Truthfulness,
yeah.
Creativity.
Yeah, great, good.
Joyful exertion.
What's that?
Joyful exertion.
Joyful exertion, yeah, great.
Too fast for me to write. How much is 5 minutes creativity, thank you.
Humour.
Uh-huh.
Concentration,
yeah.
Helpfulness,
yeah.
Fearlessness.
Mm-hmm, great.
Kindness.
What was that?
Kindness.
Kindness, yeah.
Detachment.
Okay. Yeah.
An open heart.
Okay, great.
Joy.
Joy, brilliant.
Respect for all living beings.
What was that?
Respect for all living beings.
Okay, yeah, great.
Discipline.
Discipline, yeah.
Love,
yeah.
Non-violence.
Non-violence, yeah.
Insight,
yeah. One more.
Honesty,
great. Okay, we could probably go on. That's just good. It's warming up. But I'll stop there because we've covered a lot. And it's not exhaustive. These positive qualities are actually by their nature. They just get more and more the more you talk about them, I think. Okay, so I'll keep my scribe here. There's a traditional list of 6 things that... Actually, I think I'll keep on that page just now. I'm going to try something. I'm going to get you to... Okay, so there's a traditional list of 6 things that describe the Bodhisattva path, yeah? And I think all these things come into the 6 things, so I'm going to just see if that works. So the first of the 6 things is generosity, so, or dana, brilliant, good, yeah. Is there any more along that nature? There's generosity. Okay, and kindness, yeah.
Helpfulness.
Helpfulness, yeah. Okay. And then the next one is ethics. Now that's going to cover quite a lot, I think. Yeah, morality.
Honesty.
Honesty. Was there something about care for all living beings? Respect for beings? Compassion, yeah.
Confession.
I think it was compassion, actually. It could be confession. But confession could count.
You're not wrong.
Yeah, and kindness, yeah.
Detachment,
yeah. You could do it, yeah, yeah. It's funny, yeah, you start to realise everything kind of covers everything, don't you?
Non-violence.
Yeah. Yes, non-violence. So there's generosity, or dana, the Buddhist word is dana, the Buddhist word for ethics is sila. And then there's patience. I didn't think you'd get that, but somebody did say patience. I think you said that, didn't you? Patience. patience or kshanti. Yeah, so that's the third traditional one. And then the next one is effort or energy. I think we had that, didn't we? With joyful exertion. I think, if it's not too of a, much of a stretch, I wondered if there was a one that was courage or fearlessness.
Yeah.
That might come under that.
There's courage at the top there as
well. Oh yeah, courage at the top there.
Oh, I thought creativity.
Ah, yes, yeah. It would, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Concentration.
Well, concentration is the next one. So that's samadhi or meditation. So that's the fifth on the list.
Concentration, that's it.
Yeah.
Here, no, the...
Oh, yeah. So that's the fifth. And then the sixth is prajna or wisdom.
Oh.
Did we have that? Insight, yeah, we got it. Yeah. Good, so I think, so is there anything we've not...
Humour.
So maybe, well, maybe we need to think that all of these need to be in the... with the spirit of humour.
And the joyful exertion.
And the joyful exertion, yeah.
But how about mindfulness?
That's concentration.
That's concentration. And actually mindfulness in this formulation, ethics in this list particularly emphasises the quality of mindfulness. So that comes into both, that you need to be mindful to be ethical. So this list of six I've given you is just one of many lists. You know, Buddhism's got a lot of lists in it. But the list of six that includes generosity, ethics, patience, energy, meditation and wisdom. Does anyone know what that's called collectively? Maybe we could have that on the next sheet. Does anyone know what those six, what the collective name for those six are? Yeah, the paramitas, yeah. Who said that? Was that... Yeah? Paramitas. Paramita. Okay, so do you know how that translates, the paramitas?
The perfections.
The perfections, yeah. It's usually translated as the perfections. There's another translation, which I think... sheds a bit more light on it. There's a scholar called Konza, Edward Konza, and he translated paramita as something like the way to the other shore or the way beyond. So you could therefore call them something like the ways to transcend ourselves. Yeah, I like that because it's got a sense of action. So the six ways to transcend ourselves or the six transcendent practices. So this list of six paramitas, so this whole Bodhicharya Avatara basically is the structure of this text. So as the weeks go on, we're going to be looking at these paramitas, these means of transcending ourselves in turn. And we're going to be starting with dana or generosity, that's this evening. But I'm going to say a little bit more first of all. So you can sit down again. Thank you very much. Thank you. That was a good list, wasn't it? And it did. Yeah. Okay, so also, so as well as covering these six paramitas, chapters 2 and 3 of this book are the basis for our sevenfold puja, which many of you will have recited and many will recite regularly. Our sevenfold puja, the basic devotional text that's used throughout the Buddhist world and that we use in Tri Ratna. So there was an earlier version of the sevenfold puja before Shantideva. But the words that we normally use, you might have recognised some of them in the readings I did, come from the Bodhicharya Avatara. So And that's chapters 2 and 3, and they're the chapters we're going to be looking at over the next good few weeks, actually. Next week's a special week, as you heard, but it kind of still sort of is included in all this, as you'll see. So over the next 3 weeks, tonight and the next week and the next week, it's going to be around chapters 2 and 3 of the Bodhicharya Avatara, from which the Sevenfold Puja is taken. And the aim of these chapters what we're trying to do is cultivate a state of mind that we open ourselves to the bodhicitta. Who can remember what bodhicitta translates? Or who knows? We've got bodhi. What was that? The will to enlightenment. Yes, so we've got bodhi again, like awakening, and then chitta of heart and mind. So it's the will to become enlightened for the sake of all beings. It's the whole spirit of the bodhisattva, who's a being who wants to be enlightened for the sake of all beings. It's the driving force for the bodhisattva path. It's not a personal thing, and that's quite important to know. It's a sort of transpersonal force, sort of beyond personal force, that we can open up to or align ourselves with and allow to act through us, as it were. As it were. You've always got to say "as it were" to save it becoming. It's not like some literal flames going to descend upon us, but as it were, it's like a force in the universe. The main thing we're trying to get at is that there's no such thing as individualistic awakening, because insight, the very nature of insight, is seeing the absence of separate selfhood, seeing interconnectedness. So it's not, the bodhicitta isn't something that an individual can have or get. So it's much better, if you're going to, because we've got to think about it somehow, it's better to think of it as a force operating in the universe, but don't even take that too literally. You must, in a way, we mustn't take anything too literally in Buddhism. As soon as we think we've got it, Buddhism's always saying, no, that's not quite it. It's always trying to force us to not settle down. So the aim of these two chapters is to cultivate a state of mind which we open ourselves to the bodhicitta and commit ourselves to practicing the bodhisattva path. So in chapter one, which we had last week, we reflected, well, that would be a jolly good thing to do, because actually it is the only thing that will finally end all suffering. No matter how much good work we do in worldly terms, and obviously people do very good work indeed, at the end of the day we will never be able to conquer old age, sickness and death. Even if we found a cure for all the diseases, even if we stop world poverty, even if we completely got rid of any armaments in the world, that would all be brilliant. But Buddhism says even if we did do all that, that's not, we can't stop there, because we can never get rid of suffering, because we can never get rid of the fact we're all going to die. We can never get rid of the fact we're all going to be separated from what we love. So how are we going to find a way to relate to that? The will to enlightenment is the only way to do that, is the only way to come into a relationship with that, that we're no longer struggling with it, so we're no longer in suffering because of that, and we're not just doing that for ourselves, we're doing it for all beings. So that's what we looked at last week, and then so this week and the following weeks, what Shantideva does is he takes us through a progressive series of reflections and like little meditations and spiritual moods, if you like, designed to lead us to a wholehearted giving of ourselves to the bodhicitta, to the Buddha, the bodhisattvas and all beings. And this is how we talk about dana here. I mean, dana or generosity can be expressed in all different ways. You know, we can give material things, we can give our time and energy. But in this text, we're talking about dana as the giving of ourselves, well, to that ideal of enlightenment for the sake of all beings. So what I'll do is I'll go through the verses again that I read. Most of us were here before tea and the meditation, and we just have a little discussion about them. Okay, so we had, the first one was, in order to embrace the precious bodhicitta, the jewel of the mind, I make offerings to the Buddhas, to the sublime Dharma, and to the sons and daughters of the Buddha, who are oceans of excellence. So that's quite, in a way, straightforward. We're making offerings. We're saying, I'm going to make offerings. So we begin by putting ourselves in the presence of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in our imagination. Then we express respect and give to them in our imagination. So I thought I would just begin by asking you, because at the very beginning of the class and the meditation, I invited you, if you wanted to imagine you were in the presence of the Buddha while meditating. Would people have tried that? Yeah, you did, yeah. And what was that like? Did anyone like to say what? Yes?
It just actually made me think I couldn't even begin to imagine what that would be like.
Okay, yeah.
I just couldn't even comprehend
right.
What that would, yeah, what that experience would be like.
Okay, yeah. And what was...
So kind of far away.
So far away. And what did that, what was that like then, to realise it was so far away?
I just felt very curious.
Okay.
Is that something I would ever feel that I could experience?
Okay. But that sounds, I like that response of curiosity, because sometimes if something's so far away, we think, oh, there's no point in even starting, you know, like I'll never be able to write like Shakespeare, or I don't know, sing like, I don't know, whoever. But it didn't sound like that wasn't the effect on you. It felt far away, but it was curious. Mm-hmm. It aroused something in you. That's very interesting. Yeah, well, probably come back to that. Yeah, thank you. Anyone else get any sense of sitting with the Buddha or what that was like?
I found it quite focusing.
Okay, yeah.
I suppose just kind of reminding me why I was sat there.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't able to maintain it for a very long time. It kind of came in and out. But when I did, I found it.
Okay, so how did that work then? How did it remind you why you were there?
I don't know, just of something bigger, of something greater, rather than just, oh, I just want to feel relaxed.
Right, yeah.
Okay. I guess.
Yeah, so give you a sense of there's something more than just, yes, feeling relaxed is nice, but there's something far more. And that, then again, the effect of that was to draw you on by the sound of it. That's great. And I think what you, yeah, go on.
That was it.
Yeah, and I think what you say about coming in and out of it is quite natural. And I think sometimes when I do that, what I say to myself, and it quite works, is, well, the Buddha's there. You know, he's just there waiting. I've gone away, you know, but the Buddha's still there waiting. Yeah, yeah. It's a bit like even when we're talking to a person, we go a bit in and out, don't we? But you just come back, yeah. Anything else? Did people feel they could get a sense of the Buddha or not? Anyone else try it? Yes.
When I tried it, I'd feel safe. I feel safe.
Okay. Yeah.
Because I know that I'll be absolutely all right. And I'll be accepted. And
right.
And usually I'm very scared in meditation.
Right.
If I did that more, then
Yeah, but that's really good, isn't it? Because, and we can remember that the Buddha is a being who like completely embodies these qualities, like metta, and like patience. An aspect of patience is forgiveness, for example. So, you know, whatever we've done, whatever we're like, the Buddha will always be accepting and metta for. Might be challenging, but will never turn away from us, in a sense, yeah. Anyone else? Was there anyone who wasn't keen on doing it, who didn't relate to it, or kind of didn't want to do it, or? So everybody gave it a go then? Yeah. Well, I mean, I must say, it's something that I've been, I think I've said this in the class before, been practicing more and more myself, just whatever meditation practice I'm doing, just trying to imagine myself in the presence of the Buddha, and I'm with other people, just trying to think, oh, well, we're all there, you know, we're all disciples, as it were. And just particularly that thing of whatever quality I'm trying to develop, whether it's mindfulness or metta or wisdom, the Buddha already embodies that. The Buddha in my imagination is a being who embodies those qualities. And that can be mysterious. That can have that sense of, gosh, I don't quite know what that would be like. Imagine being metaphor all the time. It seems almost unimaginable, but that has a drawing on effect. So Shantideva's taking this one step further, that we're putting ourselves in the presence of the Buddha, and then we're conjuring up in our mind's offerings. So the next verses go, conjuring them up in my mind, I offer all the flowers in the world, all the fruits and all the fragrant herbs. I offer the clear, refreshing waters, the crystal mountains, the tranquil forests and the wild places. I offer vines bright with flowers. I offer trees heavy with fruit. I offer lakes adorned with lotuses and the haunting cry of the wild geese. So basically, it's the beauties of nature. So they're mind offerings. So we're conjuring these in our minds and imagining offering them to the Buddha. So why do you think Shantideva starts there? So he starts because he goes on and offers more and more kind of amazing things. So why do you think he starts with offering the beauties of nature? Yes.
Is it to develop, when you recount all of those things, you become very appreciative straight away.
Yeah. I think that's it, but that they in themselves, it's often when we're in nature, we do actually naturally feel a sense of kind of wonder, don't we? Some, you know, and so on. So it already puts us in touch with that, and then in our mind we offer that. Yeah. Do people feel that in nature, a sense of the beauty of it, the wonder of it even? Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? We were, a few of us here were on retreat at the weekend. The stars were particularly bright, and there is just this sense of, oh, it's amazing. You know, you do just naturally get into that sense of wonder. Yeah. And we can bring those to mind. You know, if we were to say those verses to ourselves, or if we're doing an ordinary sevenfold puja, we can imagine those things, and then we could, you know, people sometimes, you know, Shantideva's written this puja. Sometimes people on retreat, well, they write a puja, you know, so you could have your own beautiful things in your imagination that you offer to the Buddha. So you're trying to think, well, what is the most beautiful thing of all? And imaginatively, if you could, you know, if you could, I would give the Buddha this most beautiful thing of all. So then we take a bit of a leap after that. So in a way, that's it's not particularly controversial in a sense. We're offering something beautiful to someone we honour. But this next verse is a bit more, it's moving into a different gear. Shantideva says, I offer myself completely to the Buddhas and their sons and daughters. Take possession of me, sublime beings. I reverently devote myself to your service. What do we think of that? Any responses, reactions?
Sort of reminds me of a kind of martyr.
Yeah.
A martyring
uh-huh.
response.
Yeah.
Have immediately makes me cringe.
Yeah. Anyone else have anything similar?
It didn't make me cringe at all, actually. Uh-huh. It was really kind of wow.
Okay.
You know, how unimaginable that somebody could give themselves totally.
Yeah. But what about you? This is you saying this now. If you were saying the page, you'd be saying, so Shanta Deva's saying it, but in the sense he wants us to say it, I offer myself completely to the Buddhas and their sons and daughters. Could you say that? Maybe I don't want to put you.
That's why it's inspiring.
Yeah, but
it's
yeah.
It's just huge goal.
Yeah, it's a huge goal. So there's. It sounds like you've got a positive response though, that you would if you could. And Jed's like, no, you're not getting me. Anyone else on this? So that's quite interesting, isn't it? I think these verses are. Like, some of us will find them very attractive, and some will think, oh, hang on a minute, you know. Has anybody else got this sort of hang on a minute when we hear take possession of me, sublime beings? I revel and devote myself to your service.
For me it sort of brings up a bit of style, like how you'd start on a path in that way.
Okay.
It sort of brought to mind the path ideal, I don't know exactly why, but.
Uh-huh.
And start out on the path is to sort of say, well, I'm going to head off, and just as I go, you know, you take possession of me as I go, kind of thing.
Okay.
Made me think of.
So again, there's a sort of positive response.
Yeah.
Any other?
On the other page, when you were translating the title of the book.
Yeah. The
second translation, I can't remember what it is now, but it sort of reminded me of that.
Yeah, A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life.
Yeah. It's just to me, it's just a fuller expression of that.
To me, it was a little bit. If I think about it in a more dilute way, saying, I give myself for the better of mankind.
Okay, yeah.
I guess the emphasis is on sons and daughters, and that means all of us.
Okay, yeah.
So I think it makes it a little bit more palatable than dramatic.
So that's good. So that word service, that sounds quite. Yeah, when you put it like that, it's positive, isn't it? It's quite noble, isn't it?
It's very much somebody having a passion to work for charity. I mean, I'm talking in dilute.
But still, it's that spirit. Yeah. Anything else on that little bit, or I could read you the next one?
Maybe sorry to extend a bit more on what I was saying. It somehow reminded me of, made me think of saying that as a very young being, like early on. But it's at the start, so of course it kind of makes sense in that way too, but sort of thinking as a young being saying, as I go along, as I get older, as I, these Buddhists take possession of me as I go, something. As saying that as a young being starting out.
Okay. So there's a sense of giving yourself to something higher or more developed.
Yeah, but at the beginning, that's sort of what I'm saying.
Yeah, okay.
That's what it reminded me of. So
yeah.
Being at the beginning.
You've been at the beginning, yeah. So there's a sort of humility to that.
Yeah. And recognising that you're at the start, you're at the beginning, you're just.
I think that is a sort of positive humility, yeah. So just to remind you of what he says after this, he says, when you possess me, I'm freed from fear. When you possess me, I work for the benefit of all. When you possess me, I'm freed from my unskillful karma, and in the future, I commit no more. So maybe I'll say a little bit more myself, and then hopefully it'll sort of it'll respond to both the positive and negative responses. So, and I think that's interesting, why might giving ourselves to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas free us from fear and other negative mental states. I think it's quite healthy to react in a way to the language of being possessed by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and that sort of sense of self-surrender. Because I think a sort of unthinking surrender of our will, well, it could lead to a lot of disasters, couldn't it? You know, a sort of gullible self-surrender would be a very foolish thing indeed to do, wouldn't it? And, well, people do it, don't they? They sort of fall under the charms of people, but especially in the spiritual life, of kind of charismatic leaders or of voices from the sky, you know, and end up doing things, you know, without taking responsibility. So I think it's positive to have a healthy wariness of this. And I think what the message here is, if we're going to practice this self-surrender, we're going to have to keep our intelligence about us, yeah? But I think one thing that we might help us is, I was reading someone who's done a commentary on this text today, and he says, actually, well, we allow ourselves to be possessed by greed, hatred and delusion, like all the time, you know. And actually, so in a sense, you could say, well, why not be possessed by something positive? If all the bodhicitta is, I mean, all, obviously it's a very amazing thing, if it is the work for the benefit of all beings, then why not be possessed by that? I kind of very quickly allow myself to be possessed by unskillful things. So maybe that's one way of thinking, you know, that we might want to think about it. And also that there is a positive, I liked what Knut said, that there is a sort of positive sense to that humility, that we can often, and very easily, and especially in the modern world today, think, oh, we've got to be independent and we've got to do it all ourselves. And there is a positive in that sort of showing initiative, but it can also cut us off from allowing ourselves to be helped and supported by those wiser than ourselves. So I think there's something, that was why I was saying it's positively humble, when we just simply realise there are beings who can help us. There are beings who we can, you know, ask for advice, kind of learn from and so on. Well, it's positive in two senses. It's positive because we can actually be helped, but also because, well, usually negative emotions are a result of our own ego clinging. So the spiritual work is to let go of ego clinging. And we can do that by doing the will of other people, but doing that consciously. So I think that's what I mean when we've got to keep our intelligence about us. Is there any questions on what I've said? I've sort of said a few things in succession. What do you think, Jed? You raised the thing about the... it makes you cringe or it makes you want to run away. Does anything I've said give you a positive sense of self-surrender? Or?
Yeah, a little bit.
still struggling with, I guess this for me it's more of an image of possession.
Yeah.
And what that evokes.
Okay. Yeah. I've been taken over and sort of subsumed. Yes. And again, I think that's quite. There is something healthy about that. That wariness. I mean, here's another sort of little teaching from Sangharaksha that I find very helpful. He gets us I've said this at the class here before, but I think it's good to say again. He says, just simply imagine what happens when someone who you really love asks you to do something. So everybody's probably had that experience, really. Somebody that we really love asks for something from us, and you do it, yeah? So people sort of on the whole think of an occasion when somebody's asked you to do something and you've willingly done it. People, yeah, think of that. So then if you ask yourself, well, whose will is that? Yeah? So is it your will? Or is it their will? Can you say whose will it is? It's ours, but they've asked you to do it.
Yeah, but it becomes ours.
It becomes ours. Okay, yeah, so that's it. So it's their will, but it's become ours, yeah? So, in a sense, the wills have become blended, haven't they? So they've asked you to do it. You might not have thought of it yourself, so in a sense, you wouldn't have done it without them. But because you've done it willingly, that will is blended. So Sangharaksha says, well, just imagine that that will, that person asking you to do the thing is the Buddha. Yeah, so you, and you then willingly did it. So all the Buddha would want would be to help all beings to liberation. Yeah, that's all he's going to ask you to do. He's not going to ask you to put your hand on the fire or something. You know, he's only going to ask you to help all beings. So if you willingly sort of said, okay, I'll be on your team, Buddha, then you've willingly done it. So that there's a sort of blending of wills. So maybe that's a way we can think of this take possession of me. You're saying, I'm willingly going to allow my will to be blended with the Buddha's, yeah? I find that quite a helpful way of thinking about it, because you can see, I think the key thing is that it's you've consciously done it. And there's another side to this as well, which is that actually they can't do it for you anyway. Bhante says, well, you can open yourself to these great spiritual forces which are there ready to help you, and they do all that they can, but they can't actually do it for you anyway. You know, so sometimes we resist surrendering, other times we just think, oh, I wish I could just surrender. I wish the Buddha could just do it for me. But actually, the Buddha can't do it for you. So Bhante says, you've got to at least respond and help yourself as well. So you can, yeah, you open yourself to the forces. You don't have to. You can sort of close yourself to it. You could go, right, I'm just not going to help anyone or do anything. If you wanted to, you can open yourself to the forces. But you've, but yeah, they can't do it for you. And that, if you sort of indulge me in a little joke, which I'm fond of telling. I remember hearing this joke about there's a big flood, and somebody climbs to the very top of the building, and the flood's rising and rising and rising, and the person's praying to God, and they're saying, oh, please, God, please, please help me, save me from the flood. And the next minute, a helicopter comes by, and the people say, jump in. And he says, no, no, I'm not jumping in, like, God's going to help me. And then he's praying. He's going, please, God, please help me. And then a ship comes by, because the water's now so high, and they say, jump in. He says, no, no, I'm not going to help. I'm not going to jump in. God's going to help me. And then he's praying. He's saying, please, God, please help me. And God says, I've sent you a ship and a helicopter. Like, what more do you want? I thought that's very funny. And I think that illustrates, well, we can pray and sort of say, it's actually, we're not going to be taken over, actually. It's not like literally there is this sort of force that's going to take us over. What we're trying to do is we're trying to sort of break out of our ego clinging. I mean, the whole problem of the spiritual life is that we know that the only way, or the Buddha's told us, the only way to sort of freedom is to break out of our ego clinging. But we've only got our ego to do that with. So how are we going to do it? We can't. It's like trying to pull ourselves up by our own shoelaces. So we've got to sort of find means of doing that. So, as it were, if we can devote ourselves to the will of the Buddha and even imagine the Buddha taking us over, then that's is a kind of means to try and break free of this. I mean, in the end, there's no individual will or will of the Buddha as separate things. In the end, all this notion will be overcome. We can only think of it dualistically, but if we've got to think of it dualistically, it's better and more helpful in a way to imagine ourselves being taken over by something that is far greater than us, because that, well, it gets us out of this narrow sense of self. If we think, oh, well, I can do it all by myself, with this kind of very limited, well, can you express it, of I'm just at the beginning sense of ourselves, we're going to get, we're sort of stuck from the outset. So this language of self-surrender, or this it's more than language, this notion of self-surrender can move us, it can just move us beyond all that. Yeah, so that's what Bhante says. He says, the fact remains, giving up your self-will is an act of tremendous self-will and self-effort in itself. It's not so easy to give up your own will. It requires a lot of effort. And then he says, well, just what I've been trying to say, later on in the spiritual life, the distinction loses its meaning in a way. You do what you can, and these other spiritual forces, as it were, will do what they can too. There's no doubt about that. And he says this lovely thing. He says, between you, whatever is necessary to be done will be done. I quite like that. So, I'd quite like us to finish up with actually bringing the Buddha to mind again. So I'll just say a few more things before that. We've got about 15 minutes to go. So that's in a way the central bit of this chapter, where we're offering our very selves. This is generosity kind of par excellence. We're offering our very beings for the benefit of all beings. And then Shantideva goes back to, he started off by offering flowers and fruits and incense and so on, and then he offers sort of imaginal things, jeweled lamps, golden lotuses, songs and poems and so on. So he offers the visionary and sort of archetypal offerings. And then bows to all beings. Bows to all beings. We talked about bowing last week as well. It's the same sort of thing. It's saying it's a sort of positive humility. Sort of acknowledging that there's beings on a higher level than us and being open to their influence. But I want to finish off by saying something else that Sangharaj just said about all this. He said it's really important to remember that worship in this way, salutation and worship, which in effect this is what this is, even though we're doing it in our mind, is an action. So it's not just, he says we mustn't think that worship is just worship. I think what he means is, it's not just something we might say or recite or listen to. It's not just words that we repeat or listen to. He says it's actually actions. That is when they're sincerely done. And he says as actions, they're karma. And that means they're productive of consequences. And in the case of worshipping the Buddhas, then that will be positive consequences. And he says that it can even counteract and counterbalance previous unskillful karmas, that is, actions of various kinds. So that's quite strong, actually. He's saying it's action. So he says, when you're creating mental pictures of offerings and making offerings with heartfelt devotion, you are actually doing something. It's not just sort of imagination in the sense of fancy. It's not just, oh, these are some nice verses we're saying. He said it's an action, a mental action, And he says, according to Buddhism, mental action is the most powerful of all, because Buddhism's teaching is that, well, everything starts with the mind. Is if our mind is in a wholesome state, then that's the most positive karma of all. So action isn't just doing something with the body, as we commonly think. So is there any responses to that before I go on to the next bit? That saying these verses is actually action. Do people think that's true? Or is that... Yes?
It reminds me of the gratitude practice that you did on the retreat that was did over the summer, and how when you reflect on being grateful for the gathering, it makes you feel different.
Yes, yeah.
It sort of concentrates your mind
yes.
on how much you have to be thankful for, and you want to keep behaving in the way that's going to produce your relationship with the thing that you're grateful for.
That's good, isn't it? What we dwell upon, we become. And those grow and develop, don't they? And similarly, I think, as you touched on with negative mental states, if we spend our whole time, for example, rehearsing arguments and so on, like, we will become a more grumpy person. It's not just that that's kind of negative in the moment or even uncomfortable in the moment. We will create ourselves into someone who's more likely to do that in the future. So whichever way we go, we sort of create this sort of either positive or negative spiral for ourselves. So what about this idea that the consequences are so powerful that they could even counteract or counterbalance previous unskillful things we've done? I mean, we're usually taught that, well, actions have consequences. If we do something unskillful, we'll reap the painful consequence. Well, what this is actually saying is by sincerely reciting these verses, we're doing a sort of opposite action that will counteract that. How does that? Do you think that could be true?
Makes me feel a bit uncomfortable.
Yeah, I thought it might. Go on. Go on.
I feel a bit uncomfortable because it brings to mind, I guess, the connotation of sort of prayer in its as an end in itself, where just the sort of recitation of wanting something is enough for things to. Be absolved in the past, bad actions in the past, or things that I want in the future.
Yeah. So it would be, so that's good, isn't it? So prayer as an end in itself would not be a positive thing, is what you're saying. Yeah.
It feels like a bargaining.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? Yeah.
So it's about, for me, it would be about what your intention is behind.
So yes, it does sound like it does sound a bit like a bargaining with who you're bargaining with. We don't, but yeah. So again, so we've got the intention behind, and then what Jez said is it's not an end in itself. So how could you? What would make it not be an end in itself?
Well, if it shifts the way you behave.
Yeah.
Actually, it reminded me of confession from a
character. Okay.
You know, the popular myth, I think, of confession is that you'd say a few Hail Marys and an Our Father and be absolved as best as you could.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, here, you make a commitment not to, you know, to not do it again.
And
recommit yourself to that.
Yeah. Yeah, so it changes the way you behave. So I guess if you were doing, if you really were sincerely saying, well, I'm putting myself at the service of beings, but you weren't just saying those words, you actually were, had an effect on you, then that would have a positive karmic effect. Yeah, I think that's what's been...
And you're taking responsibility. responsibility for your own actions.
Yeah, yeah. So I think again that's the key thing, and I think we've it's always we're kind of. It's like we can go too far one way, like going too far into the prayer would just be, well, it would just be superstition, wouldn't it? We'd just think, well, I can be as unskillful as I like, but yeah, I'll say a few prayers, then I'll be all right. But being too literal about it and just thinking that, well, every karmic thing I've done has to, I have to suffer the consequences. I mean, I remember one teacher said, actually, you never could do it. You've done so many unskillful things. Actually, you would never actually come to an, you know, so there's something that maybe is, we don't want to see it as account keeping. I think that was good you brought that up. It's not like, well, if I do this, but that maybe even by this attitude, something a little bit hesitant to use, sort of magical might happen. Yeah, that we're almost a sort of sense of grace might happen where we're calling on something higher than ourselves for help, and maybe we really will be helped. Yeah, maybe we, it's sort of believing that we really will be helped. At the same time, not literally thinking there is a being out there who's going to go, oh, it's all right, all is forgiven. Yeah. So I think these are the sort of caveat. We're trying to open ourselves, but not take it literally. Yeah. We're trying to be receptive, but not gullible. Yeah. So, and I think the key is probably just, well, I keep saying there's not sort of leaving our intelligence behind us. It's sort of intelligently practicing. I think I've run out of time to do the mantra, but I just want to say one more, which is what I was going to do. But I just want to say one more thing, and it sort of sets us for next week, because we've got a very special week next week, as Sila Pia said. So Sangha actually goes on to say that the greatest expression of your devotion of all is when you say, to the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go. So it all culminates there. So real devotion is when you commit yourself. Real devotion is when you, what we say is, go for refuge to the three jewels. He says you can make all these wonderful and glorious offerings in your mind or even in reality, decorate the shrine, raise canopies, throw jewels around, but then if you end up not going for refuge, then it's all been fruitless. If you end up not committing yourself, if you end up not letting it affect your actions, then it's all has been fruitless. I think that ties in with what's been said. So that's why in our Sevenfold Puja, for example, you have worship, you have salutation, and then you have going for refuge. You can't stop short of that. In a way, that's what all this devotion and worship is culminating in. So so this is preparing us for next week. So next week we're not going to be studying in the same way. I think Sila Pia said what we're going to have is we're going to be welcoming someone who has formally gone for refuge. We're going to be welcoming a new order member. He's not an order member yet. I hope he is going to become an order member, or else we're not going to be able to welcome him. He could change his mind at the last minute, but let's hope he doesn't. Let's hope that the person who was called David is going to spiritually die, spiritually be reborn, and then come back here. And I was going to say tell us about it. He might not even speak, you know. You might, sometimes you can't speak after an experience like that. But he's going to, all being well, come and grace us with his presence. So really, really invite you. It's just fabulous when this happens. You know, it doesn't happen too often, maybe once or twice a year, that we have people coming back from an ordination retreat and just being with us and sharing what they can of that experience, and we in our turn can just go like, fantastic, brilliant, and sort of shower them with our worship, really, for someone who's taken that step. I mean, don't mean worship and that we're going to like bow at their feet, but you know, we're going to say, well done, you know, that was brilliant what you've done. So we'll be showering them with streamers and so on. So that's next Monday. Also on Sunday, we've got the festival, Padmasambhava Day. At that festival, some people are going to become mitras. Some of them are even here. I won't embarrass them unless they want to make themselves known. Are going to become mitras. Oh no, maybe they're not. Maybe there's none here, actually, who are going to become mitras. But the way people take a step of going for refuge, also formally saying that they want, that they're going for refuge and becoming a friend of Tri Ratna. It's not as committed a step as becoming an order member, but still, it's declaring their alliance. That they are a Buddhist, and you can come and witness that ceremony, and again give your metta to those. There'll be about 6 or 7 or 8 people taking this step on Sunday evening's puja. So it's really fitting that it's come at this part. I'd like to say we planned it all like this, but we didn't quite. But it's very, very fitting that we've talked about worship and salutation and that self-surrender, and that all culminates in going for refuge. And then we've got both Sunday and Monday evenings, people actually formally, in the case of David, formally taking the ordination vows, going for refuge. In the case of the mitras, making the 3 declarations of becoming a mitra. It's also a great way to find out what being a mitra, what being an order member means, without even having to sort of tell anybody that you're in. You can just sit in the audience and sort of have a look and sort of see what it's all about. Yeah, so do, particularly invite you to come next Monday, but also Sunday. So that's everything. Now, if on your way out you'd like to, I was going to do a mantra, but there isn't time. But do feel free to come if you want to, just make an offering of incense before the shrine, bow before the shrine, if you want to on your way out. Not just tonight, but any week, you know, on your way out and your way in, do feel free to bow before the shrine and make an offering of incense at the end. Yeah, so that's all for this week. Thank you.